Blog Talk Radio. welcome to Into the Darkness. I am Pam Ray. With me, as always, my co-host, Intimidus Rex. Rex and I are poets on a website called All Poetry with a group of poets called Late Night Poets. You don't have to belong to the group or the website to call in, share, listen, and enjoy, but it is highly recommended. Now, tonight is our dark poetry night. It is also an after midnight show, which means while we do not allow for smut or porn or overly graphic violence, we do allow for a bit more adult content. If neither of those are your cup of tea, please check out our other shows. We have up to 2 shows per night with a variety of styles and topics of poetry, something for everyone's taste. Also, when you get a chance, go to Amazon and check out the poetry anthologies put out by Late Night Poets. Because when you purchase those, you not only get amazing poetry, you help support these radio shows. And hello, Rex. How's it going?
All right. How about you?
Oh, that's going great. I'm looking forward to tonight's show. We had put out a contest on All Poetry with the artwork of Ivan Albright and got a great response. A full board with some quality dark rights. So, you know, no matter how the rest of the day goes, it's always fun to know that you're going to be commenting and reading poetry and hanging out with other poets. So I'm all good. But, yeah, Ivan Albright, I don't know if you knew this, but he was actually very well known because he was one of the old movies of The Painting of Dorian Gray. He was the one who did the painting for the movie.
Okay.
Yeah, just a little tidbit of information there. I liked his style. It was almost like caricatures, and yet very much had a harsh reality of the human form. He did not, he painted people to be as they were. And it was almost kind of a haunting way that he painted the everyday man and the everyday woman. And go ahead and bring on a couple of guests. I'd like to say welcome to Laurent and welcome to Babbler. Glad you could both join us.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Rex.
So I'm glad you were both inspired. Now, did either of you know about Ivan Albright's artwork before, or did you, was he an artist you knew? Because I know a lot of people did. I have to admit, I did not. I don't know how, but I didn't.
I did not.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I wasn't the only one.
Well, it's not a style that would immediately draw the eye unless you looked at it more carefully.
Yeah, you're right there, Lauren. And that's what I liked about it, was the fact that I knew people would have to look a little, you know, deeper. So. All right. And we'll go ahead and get this ball rolling. And all right. And I'm going to go ahead. Have you read first, Lawrence? So there's your poem. Go ahead, give it a read.
All right. This is called Stone Soup. My belly lies empty, desirous of weight within and without. In truth, I am no dimpled-cheeked fairy creature, fallow-eyed and mindless. Men's eyes do not follow me, targeting their hunter's gaze. They have other game to chase. Let the deer flee, and the great pack seek secret paths, ghosting the forest. Beware the woodsman's scent, for they would dress in wolfskin and leather. I dress myself in a common skin of no great repute, never hunted for its beauty. Fools, they seek the obvious, ignoring my buried treasure. Under my modesty, I have breasts that burn for a touch, a caress. My sex aches for a lover to ravish me, take me in delirious rapture. Yet here I sit, hands rough from peeling potatoes, carving out unblinking eyes, firm white flesh, colder than my own warmth, still aching to be tasted, and waiting to taste. If any devil wants his due, then he should present himself for the great unveiling, a moment in which I practice dark culinary arts of a virgin in waiting who claims long pork as first ingredient for her stone soup. And poem.
Wonderful read there, Laurent. Thank you. And Rex, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
All right. I'd go with brutal at first thought, but it's only slightly that way. And that's meant there for effect, because it's actually a touch on the sadness, sad angle, with the thought, but there's a heavy longing for the need in the warmth of another person, and that comes with there's some great lines in here. Let me see, what was it? Firm white flesh, colder than my own warmth, still aching to be tasted. There's that combination between the woman and the potatoes was a nice touch. I like the thought with almost the second to last stanza, a moment in which I practice dark culinary arts of virgin waiting. Who claims long pork? There's a touch of humor to that, because she's not actually referencing maybe the thought to eating human flesh, but actually enjoying the dining in it sexually.
Well, being a dark show, I used long pork and the obsolete human flesh when eaten as food by cannibals. And remember, in the first stanza, I seek weight within and without. She wants food in her belly and on, and something on her belly.
Okay.
Thank you, Rex.
You're welcome. Boy, I should have caught
well
that.
Well said there, Rex. And I'm going to go ahead, and before we continue with commenting, I'd like to bring somebody on. This is area code 703. You're on the air. Who are we speaking to?
Well, you get three guesses, and the first two don't count. Good evening.
Hey, Bobby. Good to hear from you. Glad you could join us.
I almost forgot about the show. I was going to go to bed and I went, wait a minute. I sat down in front of my computer and I had the page up and I was, oh, I'm late.
Well, wonderful.
I heard you. Me too. And I heard Laurent just as he started, and this is a very macabre piece. And I did notice the reference at the beginning, my belly lies empty within and without, and then the arcane reference to long pork. I caught that immediately. And so this is you've got a very intricate, very complex right here, and it dances in and out of the macabre. And very dark, very scary. I don't think I want to meet this lady in Dark Alley.
Well, it is a dark show.
Yeah, but you do dark with the sequins and beads and lace and fancy stuff. So, you know, you're not just dark, you're fancy dark.
Wow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said there, Bobby. And Babbler, your thoughts?
Oh, I really liked it. You know, it's almost like some kind of hideous praying mantis or some kind of like mythological creature. You know, I have a feeling that there'll be something happening prior to the eating of the long pork. Maybe different helpings of the long pork, if you will.
Yes, exactly.
But I love it. It's dark and twisted, and I think it really matches the art style.
It truly does. It truly does. You're absolutely right. I have to agree with everybody. You know, this wonderfully dark right, and it catches you off guard with the picture and how there really is a sense of sadness to it. And you, like, the thing with the picture is there really isn't an exact emotion, a very strong emotion within the face. And so it leaves it open to interpretation of what she's thinking about. And I like how you took it down that dark path of that woman who has, like, almost that mocking tone towards the foolishness of men and that desire to taste meat. So, excellent, right?
It's a very lurid piece.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you, Pam.
All right. And on to next one, which will be Babbler. And let me get that posted. There we go. The poem is up, Babbler.
All right. This is Progress. One, born with calloused thumbs, accustomed to overtime, the cattle and the corn rows do not care that it is Sunday. God must wait for the water line to drop neath the blue mountaintops to harvest salt. The sun beats hot over fertile land. Waterlogged children flock to the city, lymphatic swelling of urban centers stagnant and scum-laden. Flies hypnotized by the blue glow. The pumpkin king bows to Hun Hunapu, pockets stuffed with copper painted gold. Kernels tumble from his twisted grin, crumbling to powder, arm punctuated by purple bruises, the crotch of his elbow, fingertip throbbing from pinpricks. Tiny jars in the refrigerator door, an indirect auto-cannibalism. Crusted soil bakes, fertilized with desiccated drones, spiracles clotted with foreign bodies. Kings and small gods mummify, their waters bottled for Dasani, can't live without it. Edemas vacuum-sealed in merino wool, grasp at fat wallets, filled with pointing fingers aimed at the shepherd for stinking up the place. The wheel is broken, spokes jabbing downward into ground. Last fly buzzes over a field of carbon. Water licks at the salt lines. The river's mouth is lined in silicone, orating a robotic funeral for the god of corn. Ones and zeros proliferate in chains, shackles for lubricated boxes, whirring predetermined thoughts. Androids do not dream of electric sheep. They dream of Sundays. End poem.
That was an excellent read. Thank you. And Lauren, wow. Your thoughts?
Well, the last thing I read, Androids Do Not Dream of Electric Sheep, was an absolutely wonderful book by Philip K. Dick, made into a movie.
Yep.
And I like the inclusion of it there. It's very clever. And backing up just a little bit, ones and zeros proliferate in chains, shackles for lubricated boxes, wearing predetermined thoughts, computers in chains, perhaps using the ones and zeros, or are the people ones and zeros? Either way, as I back off, I'm going backwards in this poem for some reason. Let me get back up to the top, excuse me. When I saw the picture of the wheelwright and read your first stanza, born with callous thumbs, accustomed to overtime, the cattle and the cornrows, do not care that it is Sunday. You know, when you're working with the earth, when you're doing the kind of things that he's doing, there really is no Sunday at all. And only robots can work 7 days a week, you know, as many hours a day as you want. So I see something in there about how the poor sometimes have to work regardless of what day of the week it is. You didn't go where I thought you'd garden with this. It's a fascinating piece, beautifully written.
Absolutely. Well said there. And Rex, your thoughts?
Yeah, let's see. I, too, was fascinated by that last line, the androids do not dream of electric sheep, they dream of Sundays, because you finish out with what you started. The cattle on the corners do not care that it's Sunday. Everything needs to be tended in their time, just like the corn and the cattle. But you keep bringing the corn back in. Let me see. You've got then you've got pumpkin, kin, basil, hun, hunapu, pocket stuffed with copper painted gold. There's a nice note to the falsity of money, so to speak. Then you bring in kernels tumble from his twisted grin. There's that note again to a corn. And it's kind of almost that thought to children of the corn kind of pops up there. But I like that thought, waterlogged children flock to the city. And there's another piece that really kind of, kings of small gods mummifying. Their water's bottled for Dasani. Can't live without it. There's a chilling tone in that note. Their water's bottled for Dasani. Their waters, as in their purified blood down to the clear level. Can't live without it. And there's another nice reference there to cannibalism in a place. And then you roll in the thought for stinking up the place, flies buzzing around. There's a whole lot of stuff to get into. And it is kind of a nicely dark end, but it also points to the kind of determination of the robots kind of actually taking over the land, and not just the land, but everything, and humans being the fodder for the machines, so to speak.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I like, Rex, how you mentioned that there's a lot to dig into in this, right? Because you're right, there absolutely is. And Bobby, your thoughts?
I think this is elegantly dark. It is so complex. You have got so much detail in this. It is absolutely fascinating. There's, again, I'm going to echo some other comments because I agree. You start with work, do not carry that it's Sunday, and then you drift down to androids, do not dream of electric sheep, they dream of Sundays, and Laurent is right. That was the book by Philip K. Dick that they made Blade Runner into.
Mm-hmm.
That was nicely threaded in there. But this is a tapestry that you have here, a word tapestry with so much detail. It's like one of those paintings that you have to stand there and focus and concentrate on, lest you miss the little intricate details. And there's you know, little minutiae like. The one intriguing line that I'm still trying to decode, tiny jars in the refrigerator door and indirect auto cannibalism. I'm still working on that one. but you've got some wonderful language in here. I'm looking for the one that was, edema vacuum sealed in merino wool, grasp at fat wallets, filled with pointed fingers aimed at the shepherd for stinking up the place. That is that passage right there is so complex. This is a very cerebral piece. This is not one to be just skated over and consumed, gulped down. This is a fine sherry. You need to sip this a little at a time to really, really appreciate it. It's a very fine piece. I think this is one of the best things you've done.
Thank you.
Great comment there, Bobby. Thank you. Wonderful comments, everybody. I have to agree, you know, first of all, I like how this very much smacks of reality. It has the darkness of that everyday life, and I think bringing up corn over and over again was – really intelligent, because if I remember right, it's the number one money-making crop in the United States. It might not be number one, but I know it's in the top. I know there's a lot of...
It's pretty close.
Yeah. There's, you know, and the money is being made for... Because what happens, what I get from this is it's the whole idea of those who get judged for not going to church on Sunday because they have to work. They have to work the farms. They have to work in the water factories to make the filtered water for the rich who are able to take Sundays off. And there's just this real sense of sadness and misery. And then there's the whole social aspect of losing one's job and one's identity, you know, the family farm to the mass production. It is a beautifully layered right, wonderfully dark, and just very well done, Babbler.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Was there anything that you wanted to say about your poem?
I enjoyed writing this one. I mean, it is pretty layered. I just, when I saw this art, there was just so much to look at, and it looks so layered, you know. And this wheel just really stood out to me, you know, about farming, but he looks so downtrodden, you know. And I work in food manufacturing, you know, so I see a lot of these supply chain changes and just the way the landscape of agriculture is changing. It's just as an explanation for that line that Bobby was talking about, the tiny jars in the refrigerator door and indirect auto-cannibalism is a nod to diabetes caused by largely consumption of corn syrup.
That was really subtle. I admire that. That was really subtle. Thank you. I'd be up wondering about that one tonight.
So, thank you, everyone.
Absolutely. All right. Bobby, your poem is up. Go ahead. Give it a refresh, please.
I'm going to issue an apology in advance because this is a very long piece. So by the time I'm done, you're going to get really tired of hearing my voice. I wanted to do justice to both the painting and the story. So this is not one of the prompts. When I saw the prompts, I recognized the artist immediately as having painted one of the two pictures in the 1945 film that they used in the picture of Dorian Gray. And so I asked permission, and Pam in her magnanimity, she said yes. So here we go. And I wish I could have gotten a bigger picture, but didn't want to get any larger than this for some strange reason. So here we go. The picture of Dorian Gray. I sent my soul through the invisible, some letter of that afterlife to spell. And by, my soul returned to me and answered, I myself am heaven and hell. From the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, the film begins and ends with this quote. That's why I included it. Prologue, London, 1886. Dorian Gray is a wealthy, fashionable young man. Though intelligent, he is callow and easily manipulated, and this leads to his undoing. Apologue. The brush strokes on the canvas reflected the face and figure of a handsome and affluent young man. He stood ever so still as Basil Hallward's brush captured his youth and beauty as nearby him the statue of Bast watched on. As he sat for his portrait, Dorian was attentive to the radical ramblings of Lord Henry Wotton, espousing that pleasure is all, youth and beauty fleeting, and that while the painting would remain forever young, Dorian would not, and he was deeply struck by this. The world is yours for a season. As so many realize too late, time is jealous of youth, and what the gods give you, they quickly take away. A man should live his life out fully, give form to every feeling, expression to every thought, reality to every dream. He should yield to every temptation. Lord Henry's words vibrating in his mind, Dorian gazed at his likeness and was devastated by the stark truth of Lord Henry's words, realizing that we suffer for what the gods give us, ephemeral gifts that vanish without presage. Quietly, Dorian spoke a wish that formed in his unconscious, a wish, almost a prayer, spoken in the presence of the figure of Bast, the Egyptian god Bast, who had the power to grant this desperate impulse, this conceit of his juvenescence, to cover eternal youth above all. If only the picture could change, and I could stay always as I am now. For that, I would give everything. There's nothing in the whole world that I would not give. I would give my soul for that. Dorian could not know that his wish, his deadly wish, foolishly made before the shining eyes of Bast, had been heard, heard in its frightful fullness, and in its frightful fullness had been granted. Driven by Lord Henry's praise of folly and exaltations of hedonism, Dorian began nightly to venture into London's half-world, exploring all manner of common establishments, till one evening, in a dreary little tavern, he chanced to hear Sybil Vane singing a lovely little music hall ditty. Taken with her, he returned each evening for a fortnight, until besotted with each other, they fell in love, became betrothed. Dorian brought Basil and Lord Henry to meet his beloved. Sadly, Lord Henry recognized an opportunity to interfere, was fomenting Dorian to test Sybil's stainless purity. Invited to see his portrait, Sybil visited Dorian's home that night, warm and inviting. But when she said she must be going, remembering Lord Henry's words, he pressed her to stay. The heart eclipses propriety, and she concedes to his request. With her concession, the ideal he had formed of her was shattered. With morning's light, he cast her off cruelly with penned contempt. Time and contemplation comes contrition, and he pens an apology. But before Dorian's note of abject atonement can be delivered, he learns of Sybil's tragic self-destruction. Sadly, when he initiated her destruction, he began his own. That day when he gazed at the portrait, he saw the changes. The expression of the face had changed. The lines of cruelty around the mouth were unmistakable. His sins would not remain a secret, for such things write themselves across a man's face. The portrait would bear the burden of his shame, and he was caught in an awful destiny. The portrait became the emblem of his own conscience. His strange and noxious fascination with pleasure would be tattooed across the portrait's face while he remained young. As the years passed, he continued his insalubrious pursuits, he watched the features of the portrait change. The face in the portrait grew bestial, sodden, and unclean. It was as if some moral leprosy was eating away at his face, and the debauched face in the painting had sweated a dew of blood. But when love entered his life again, with Basil's niece, Gladys, his long-dormant conscience awakened and recognized his love for Gladys was his chance for redemption. He would claim his soul and begin to cleanse his life, and he resolved not to consummate his love for Gladys. But the temptation of the portrait remained. And so long as the portrait and its power was there, he could not be certain that his resolve would not waver. And as he contemplated the debauched horror of the face, he knew that the portrait must be destroyed. Seizing a nearby paper knife, Dorian plunged it into the portrait. But when the knife pierced the heart of the portrait, an extraordinary thing happened. Shortly thereafter, Dorian's friends, who had been searching for him, stood before the remains of a man, his face, sin, personified. Epilogue. Nearby stood Dorian's portrait. Basil's brushstrokes on the canvas reflected the face and figure of a handsome and affluent young man, his youth and beauty captured in oil on canvas as near it the statue of Bast watched on. End poem.
That was a wonderful epic read there, Bobby. Hey, Rex.
Yeah.
Would you mind, I'm having some internet problems, so would you, while we're commenting on Bobby's poem, would you grab the link for Mamyaw's poem, because that will be the next one we'll read.
Okay.
All right, thank you. And I have to say, Bobby, that was absolutely epic. You know, I remember when I used to do telemarketing, and one of the things that we always were told was to pay attention when we're reading, to pause, pitch, and punch. And yours was like definitely a 4-star rating. I have to say I was really glad when you popped into the contest and you knew exactly what poetry you wanted to write to. And I was perfectly happy to have you write to that picture because, you know, you can't in a contest put every piece of artwork from an artist that has ever existed. And so when somebody knows an artist and they appreciate an artwork, piece of artwork, that's the one you definitely want them to write to. I really like how you could tell by the elegance of the language that you wrote in and by the tone of your voice that you have an admiration and appreciation not only for the artwork itself, but for the story of Dorian Gray's picture by Oscar Wilde. So very cool there. Very well done. And let's go ahead and get you some comments. And Babbler, your thoughts.
I put her to sleep.
Put her to sleep. Are you on mute, Babbler?
I
might have actually had to go. Oh, there she
is.
Now
she's there.
You don't hear me at all?
Yeah.
Oh, now we do.
I'm not
now
on
we
mute.
Do.
Hear you. Okay. I'm not on mute. I didn't unmute myself. I checked it twice. I don't know.
Oh, wow. Yeah, okay. For a little while, we couldn't hear you at all.
Yeah. I'm just like, I don't know. So I'm checking my mute, and I'm like, I'm not muted. I don't know. maybe I was just dreaming that I was talking. I don't know. No, yes, this was quite an epic. I loved the addition of the bird song in the background as the nod to the song in the film. I have not read the book or seen the movie, believe it or not. One of those weird side effects of growing up without electricity, there are certain things you just don't run into. But I feel like, you know, this really kind of summarizes the story rather eloquently. Like, and I feel like I got an expertly done abridged version of the novel, and it was really quite beautiful. And I love that they included the art before and after.
Thank you.
So I can see the changes in the painting, you know, to go along with the story. I think the visual elements that were included in the piece really added to it. So, well done.
Thank you.
Well said there, Babbler. And Lawrence, your thoughts?
Well, I was really impressed by this piece. It's difficult in a work of this length to maintain an accurate continuity of story. It really takes a great deal of concentration. At least it does for me. And the temptation is always there to skip something and make it a little easier on yourself. But
Bobby took her time and laid the story out properly. At no point did I sense I was listening to anything that had not been written professionally for public entertainment. It was a great tight rendition of the original. I must share the same comment made earlier that I haven't seen the movie, and I have not read the book either. I only know vaguely of the story, so I can appreciate what you did here. Really, really engrossing story. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Well said there, Lawrence. Yeah, what I really like is that anybody who knows this story, has read it or seen the movie, is going to appreciate the elegant language and the way you put your heart into it. And as Lawrence said, you stayed focused and didn't skip details. And someone who doesn't know it, their appetite is going to be whetted. And I think that's very important. So, excellent right there. And Rex, your thoughts?
It's a grandiose portrait befitting both ends of it. I like to start using the Ruby out of Omar Khayyam thought to open up. That was a nice touch. Especially that last line, I myself am heaven and hell. And there is a nice reflection of this. What most don't know is the book was considered scandalous at the time, so something of a homoerotic. And he was already running around London as the aesthetic, the beauty of taking out the drab color of Victorian England and putting in the frills and the light muted new tones of color, which brightened up the what was termed in the day dandies. And he did have a wife. He also had two kids, but he did leave her for this life that he played around in the city itself, in which he finally eventually had to pay for. So the book kind of wends a little bit of story from himself into the voice of this because of the thought you've got time is jealous of youth. He's young and beautiful, and he wants to stay that way, and he wants to enjoy the hedonistic values that he's dipping into, which is part and parcel of the story itself. And there was a quote. He's got one really outstanding quote that I love. As creative acts, there is no significant difference between art and murder. And he offered that up somewhere around Jack the Ripper's time running through London. So.
Oh, very cool.
It was a nice twisted bit of a thought. And he meant it because there is, to the person who does a real horrific act of murder, it's almost like painting a portrait of themselves. So that was his idea between the two.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. I like how you have edit those little details and a bit of information. That's very cool. I have to agree. That is a wonderful quote. And thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you. I did put the information on in the author's note on the two paintings. And the original, the Albright version of Dorian Gray is actually now hanging in the Art Institute of Chicago. And I've seen it because I grew up in Chicago. My grandmother used to always take me to museums. So this is a personal favorite and a personal right for me because I've always loved the movie and I've read the book. And I love Oscar Wilde's work.
Oh, absolutely. Very cool that you grew up around Chicago. I have an aunt who lives in that area, and I've been there a few times. But just absolutely, some of the most delicious food comes from Chicago, I think, anyways. And
thank you, everyone. I'm glad you enjoyed the piece.
Absolutely. All right, Rex, go ahead if you don't mind. Not Babbler, sorry. Doy, Mamyov's piece up and give it a read for us.
It is a aha.
That tells you how blind I am.
The Old Ballerina by Mamyov. Swollen ankles, bruised toes, battered body, shattered egos. She dances in the dark stage, a lone light following her movements. Her body betrays her and she falls to the audience's tepid applause. She gets up and holds her head high, a taut smile bisecting her face. Her foundation starting to crack, hooded eyes twinkle with welling tears. Swollen ankles, bruised toes, battered body, shattered egos. She falls again as giggles arise from the darkness of the theater. This time, she remains slumped, her chest heaving as the dam bursts. The music screeches to a halt. Silence spreads like a flood. For a time, it stays put that way until her scream breaks it. Swollen ankles, bruised toes, battered body, shattered egos. And poem.
Wonderful read there, Rex. Thank you. And Mamyov, such an excellent write that really grabs at the heart. Thank you for sharing it with us. And Bobby, your thoughts?
I always enjoy Mamyov's work. She sees things I think she just has an insight into artwork. This is a wonderful piece. It's very melancholy. I like the repetition of the refrain, the swollen ankles, bruised toes, battered body, shattered egos, just reinforces the despair of the dancer who can no longer dance. And the line, silence spreads like a flood. I really like that. That just so descriptive. Yeah, I really enjoyed this piece. It was very well done.
For sure, sure. Excellent comment. And Laurent, your thoughts?
She's so convincing in the way she describes the failures of the dancer. I mean, to fail and then fail again with laughter, giggles arising from the darkness of the theater. And then the scene, you know, the music screeches to a halt. Silence spreads like a flood until her scream breaks it. And you just, I mean, she conveys the scene so realistically that honestly it makes me squirm in discomfort at the very thought of having to see something like that. It's, you know, dark comes in all flavors. This is emotionally, psychologically very dark.
Yes.
Absolutely. I like the way you said squirm with discomfort, and I have to agree with you. And it is a psychological darkness about that kind of reality that makes us uncomfortable to think about having to see. Well said there. And Rex, you read that beautifully. Your thoughts?
All right. It isn't just about the Old Ballerina. It's about the prima ballerina who has aged. Swollen ankles, bruised toes, battered body, shattered egos, points to that note of all that she's put into and given over the years, as she still has that urge, that fight to go out and give it her all in a last performance or the ending of a career. She wants to go out on a high note. Then you get this thought, her body betrays her and she falls to the audience's tepid applause. There's that moment there, the audience actually thinks that this is part of the routine. And again, she's hitting on the fact that this isn't, she knows she's not her best. She's welling up with tears. And then again, that noted thought with the swollen ankles, bruised toes, battered body, shattered egos is that annoying thought that niggles her brain and her body as a whole. And then she falls again as giggles arise. Now the audience is getting to that point where it's crushing her. And then he hits on that note, music screeches to a halt, silence spreads like a flood until her scream breaks. There's that note of anguish, that finality. She knows she can't go on, yet she's given it. she like again with the four-line stance, the swollen ankles, bruised toes, leaving it at all out on the field or the stage, so to speak. But this time it breaks the wrong way, and it she goes out on a note that she did not want to go out on, and that is the broken prima ballerina instead of the former exalted prima ballerina.
Absolutely, absolutely. I like that you observed that. I had that similar thought that, you know, like you said, it's not just about what she has become, but what she put herself through. Because anybody who has watched ballet or even just seen pictures of ballerinas knows that they have their bodies go into positions that human bodies are not meant to go into. They put a lot of physical exertion upon themselves. And there is, as you said, Rex, that sense of sadness of wanting to go out on a high note, wanting to be as beloved as she was in her prime, and pushing herself up too far to the point of collapse. Wonderful comments, everybody. This was beautifully psychological, emotional, and just that you feel for this character all the way through, and a wonderful capture of the painting. So definitely very well done there. And all right. And now that my internet has come back and my screen is working, can get to the next right. All right. Up next is Patina Painter Pelt's Conventionality, and by Eric Svensson, and we do have a SoundCloud for that, so I will mold you over to the studio and push play as soon as I get over there. All right, and okay, gotta wait to refresh. Sorry. It's annoying because what happens is anytime I shut down and I go back on and I get to the studio, it says you have an hour before your show is going to start, and I'm like, well, I know that's not true, so I will go ahead and refresh. And all right, and let's find Eric. Here we go.
Patina Painter Melts Conventionality. Due diligence applied. Impasto pigments cleave. Heave hefty ocean rocks out of patchwork quilted waves. Moody rock face cliff broods Heathcliff heavy. Frowns upon lower light struggle. Halted darkness fights to break free. Ominous pigment anchors aquamarine ocean deeper. Patina Painter Melts Conventionality. Beauty's bane reduced to dark age of perception. Caricatures lure internal infractions. Actions arrested attest to hard times. Light battles, fights thundercloud tone. Evanescent rainbow colors, a misdemeanor. Sonnet bonnet too restrictive. Straight jackets like vindictive vague paint pigments. Sunshine watered down to eternal grays. Copperplate hammered expressions glare. Caricatures caught in dismal due diligence days. Heavy paint applications stifles breath. viewers moored alongside dark, desolate quays. Frugal light application at rest demure denizens. Patina painter dances duality. Impasto laid frugality smites radiant day hollow. Moody tones tell of night's drab color. Scowl, hollow, or in disdain howl. This artist is wiser than the oldest barn owl. End poem.
Great read, Eric. Thank you very much for SoundCloud. It is greatly appreciated. And Bobby, why don't we start with you? What did you think?
Oh, my goodness. This is one of those pieces that is so complex and so cerebral that it requires several readings to really, truly appreciate the complexity of it. Due diligence applied, impasto pigments cleave, heave hefty ocean rocks. And the use of painter's language, impasto and patina, it's just beautifully woven into. This is another tapestry piece, beauty's bane reduced to dark ages perception. And the alliteration in this is just sparkling. Caricatures caught in dismal due diligence days. Viewers moored along dark, desolate caves. This is quite an impressive piece, and beautifully written and beautifully read by him.
Thank you very much, Bobby. And Laurent, how about you?
I think on the board, Laurent was saying good night.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Babla. Well, since you opted that one up, how about you? What did you think?
Oh, I loved it. You know, I felt like his descriptions and the mix of the landscape itself with the painterly terms added motion to the act of painting. It was almost like watching the artist paint it. You know, the different textures and motions. You know, the due diligence applied, you know, and the cleaving the rocks with the brush. I just really loved it. It was like watching him paint the storm while in the storm. I just thought it was great. I really loved how much motion there was in it. So I thought this was a really excellent piece.
I like that interpretation. I walk along that same theme. As though you're sitting there watching him lay this piece by piece as he walked through it, using words to describe the onboard thought of watching the artist draw on this. I too like the thought with the impasto, that standout note to laying the paint on thickly enough so it actually stands off of the canvas a bit more than other things. And I too like the thought you got cleave and then heave to follow the next. And then that moody rock face cliff broods, Heathcliff heavy, offering up a little note to Wuthering Heights was another nice touch. And going in with the darkness, vaulted darkness, ominous pigments, beauty's bane reduced to dark ages perception. Everything that he's using in here hits on those notes of darkness, spikes, thunder cloud tones, effervescent rainbow colors, a misdemeanor. And I thought that was a nice, clever touch, why the brighter colors are not being used. It's illegal. And then the thought, you got sonnet bonnet, and you've got a vindictive, vague paint pigments, dismal. This thing kind of walks in that tone of darkness without being overly done in darkness. And that last stanza itself walks really nicely. Patina painted dances duality, impasto layered frugality, smites radiant day holler, moody tone tell of night's drab collar, scowl holler, or in disdain howl. This artist is wiser than the oldest barn owl. And there's a clever summing up totally of the thoughts of the painting itself. All right, Pam, it's up to you.
Yes, I am back. Thank you, X. Excellent comment there. And I really like this. First of all, wonderful alliteration, just very eye-catching phrasing. And I like how, as you mentioned, that the it's almost subtle in its darkness, and yet it's still obviously there. And that last stanza could definitely, especially those last three lines, could easily be a poem in themselves. And to me, what I like is how his words capture the mood that's put into the painting. Like the ocean, nature is many things, and the ocean is, just absolutely can be the most calm and beautiful thing, or just violent and angry and moody. And here he captures the moodiness of the painting, the emotion that's put into it, even though it's an inanimate object. So I think that's just very well done. And, of course, SoundClouds are always very much appreciated. And back to Late Night Poets. And looks like, okay, Lawrence had to go. Good night, Lauren. Thank you for joining us. All right. Then we will move on to the next poem, and that is Straight Lines Within a Circle by Titus Llewellyn, and we have a SoundCloud for that one, too. So, all right, let's find that, and here we go.
Straight Lines Within a Circle, pi r squared. The classical form, no shortcuts you'll see. As wheel writes, a hub of the wheel, me, it will include taking on the equal load each to their own. A straight line from each end, it will enable a right angle from the ground. Throughout the turn of the wheel, it's round, beginning to end. Point B between A and C, it would indicate one to another, all will agree. Keeping the point fixed at the center the same. It has been said of the slide rule where the aim to draw a line anywhere along that perimeter. The same can be said somewhat to the letter. There's strength at the thin end of the wedge. It'll remain as smooth a ride along that edge.
Great recording there. Thank you, Titus. And I would like to mention that if you cannot call into the shows, but you can make a recording of your poem using SoundCloud or YouTube, that is very much appreciated, because then we get to hear your poetry in your voice. And Rex, let's hear your thoughts.
Hey, I like the thought of giving voice to the wheel itself and what makes the wheel a functional object in and of itself. By using I am the hub, that is where everything centers on, and everything walks out from there in equal fashion. Each line spreading the spoke itself bears weight on each angle all the way through, and you do hit right angles when that point of the wheel hits the road right, but you also end up with a smooth ride, because there is the property of correct use of angles and distance between each spoke, which makes the ride the smooth one, because everything lays out as a singular in motion, and it all works with the hub being the center ground point, which makes the whole thing work to begin with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said there, Rex. And Babbler, your thoughts.
I love the creative use of math in a poem. I would have never in a movie just looked at this and thought to examine the angles of the wheel. I think that's just an interesting perspective. I do
love the meter of this. The way that it flows is really nice. And, you know, again, when you're teaching people things in a poem, I always think there's merit in that. You know, and some people may not know or understand these things about geometry. And then that last couplet, you know, there's strength at the thin end of the wedge. It'll remain as smooth a ride along that edge. You know, it almost has like a double meaning to it, you know, kind of like working in tandem as a group, their strength. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a clever piece and a perspective I would not have thought of.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I have to agree with you about those ending lines. There is a certain, it seems to be a certain duality to them. But well said there. And Bobby, your thoughts?
Well, the engineer is sitting here smiling right now. Because I love the way he has taken science and mathematics and given it color and texture and for someone like me who sees science and physics everywhere. Matter of fact, I'm the only person I know that when the weather gets bad and people drive badly, I don't yell epithets at them. I scream coefficient of friction. They think I'm quite mad, but that's okay. This is just so elegant. It's taken science and mathematics and physics. And it's turned it into a word ballet, and this is just so delightful to take this out of its element and put it in poetic form and give it a whole new perspective, and a whole new complexion. I really enjoyed this. I like where his mind took the picture, because I'm one of those people that will look at something like this and think to myself, gee, I wonder how many triangles I can find in this.
Right?
He's taken the wheel and the straight lines and has just done something absolutely wizard with it.
Absolutely. I have to say I've enjoyed all three of your comments, because I feel like each of you has a wonderfully different way of seeing the right. So I like that. And, you know, I just, and to me, I see how, like, the parts, I'm not a math-minded person, but I see the emotional part of it, like how the parts of the wheel work together and the parts of a family and a community have to work together. And I also get nostalgic because I think of my mom's mom, who was very much an artist and a collector, and she had those old-fashioned spinning wheels that
this is very suggestive of that. Well said. Well spotted.
Yeah, and it's to me the spinning of the wheel was just always, I remember watching the wheel spinning as a child, and it felt so relaxing and so hypnotic. And so I just think that this is a work this is a rite that works on many levels, depending on the kind of mind you have that that's what will be brought out for you. So excellent rite. Excellent. And up next, and good night, Babbler. Thank you for joining us. Always appreciate you. And, well, I got to say, I think this tire picture, wheel picture, was a very popular one. We've had a few tonight.
Isn't it strange how that happens?
It is. It's interesting. It gives you an idea of what people are drawn to. All right, and this is Where People Are by Julie Buck, and it goes like this. you collect dishonor like others collect coins. How is it I have contorted and twisted myself into fitting into that ego whore puzzle you call a brain? Fools birth trust and then begrudge the liars. Take a trip inside your head and trash the point that is coming, but it will still cut. There's no escaping the message. Go ahead, cook up a new meaning. No one will ever taste it. How, why would hungry you opt out of my toy trunk only to find your own cold playground? Funny, funny how you still don't know that only I control which wheels you turn. Listen, I've been in the eye of the storm, and it's much warmer than out here where people are. It's not a tragedy to recognize that the ocean is not as deep as once believed and that everyone is a user by far. So, Sailor Man, stop with that stare and, goddammit, grow a pair. End poem. Oh, I like that one.
Great
that
read.
That was fun to read.
Great read.
Thank you. Thank you. And why don't you go ahead and continue with your thoughts on the poem, Bobby?
Okay. That's what I get for opening my mouth. I really love this. This is quite different. It's got a very colloquial approach to it, very, very almost conversational in its tone, and that she's chiding and castigating this person, and then in the end she says, God, stop with that stare and grow a pair. That's beautiful. But some of these lines are great. It's let's see, take a trip inside your head and trash the point that is coming. Oh, I think I have to remember that one and use it sometime. There is no escaping the message. Cook up a new meeting. No one will ever taste it. This is superb. The metaphors are so well laid and well laced together. I really, really enjoy this.
Absolutely. I have to agree. She does lace things together nicely. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, for me, it comes as that that sense of self within that speaks, yet you don't ever opt to let it out of the bag, so to speak. There's a note of, what was it, funny how you still don't know that only I control which wheels you turn. And the thought with that last line kind of hits onto the point up top. You collect dishonor like others collect coins. There's a kind of put down there. And then you roll into, so Sailor Man, stop with that stare and God damn it, grow a pair. A note to, you know what? Maybe it's time to actually offer up something of a rejoinder rather than taking the lip that is forced upon you.
I like that. I like that. And you're right. It does almost, like, especially with that one line about I'm the one who controls the thought, it does have the thought of somebody talking to themselves, you know, telling themselves that they need to grow a pair and stop. Letting other people walk all over them and you know, start thinking for themselves. And I think that was an excellent observation there. I do like the attitude in this. I like there's almost like a social message in the line, how, why would hungry you opt out of my toy trunk only to find your own cold playground? To me, that's a very strong line speaking of, you know, almost being offered, I don't want to say the easy life, but maybe it's almost like there seems to be a moral struggle of not taking what would make life easier because it goes against your personal convictions. I could be way out there, but, you know, just sharing some thoughts. And as always, I really appreciate Julie's writing in the way she does a conversational tone, as you mentioned, Bobby. So very well done there. And see what we have next. All right. Up next is Recital for One by Darkened Auras. And Bobby, would you give that a read for us, please?
Certainly. Recital for One, Darkened Auras. The place was closed. The stage was set. A recital practice for this brunette. She put the spotlight on the center floor, put on the music and closed the door. She shut her eyes and danced away with pirouettes, slides, and sways, twirling, swirling, agile hops, and all bowing down at her curtain call. Her eyes now open, there in the light, a single red rose, but there should be no flowers tonight, and thorn.
That was a wonderful read, and thank you, Darkened Aura, for that write. Much appreciated. And Rex, your thoughts?
She paid attention to that picture and gave an ease of thought piece all the way to the end, and then drops in that Phantom of the Opera feel. There shouldn't be any flowers there because she is alone, or supposed to be alone.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, it does have that feel to it. Very cool. And a single red rose, but there should be no flowers tonight. Nice catch there. Yeah, and I like how she has those short, tight lines and that rhyme beautifully. There's almost a sense of the control that a ballerina has. She has that same control in her lines, and I like that. And Bobby, your thoughts?
I agree. It's very compact, short stanzas, very almost staccato, and in the rhyming part, but still beautifully. The cadence is very smooth, and it gives you a sense of she's alone. She's dancing for herself. It has a very eeriness at the ending, a single red rose. She opens her eyes now. They're in the light of a single red rose, but there should be no flowers tonight. And it gives you a sense of this otherworldliness, like she's not really been alone, and she didn't realize it until she saw the flower. Like Greg said, it has that Phantom of the Opera quality to it.
It really does. It really does. Absolutely. Great comments. And all right. Go ahead. On to the next poem. And I have to say, I miss Thomas D. calling in, but I understand that, you know, sometimes, you know, after midnight shows are just a little too late. So that's understandable. But we have a write of his up next, Dirty Hands by Thomas B. And Rex, will you give that a read for us, please?
Dirty Hands by Thomas B. I am only the blacksmith, the one who wields the hammer, greases the hub, gets life to turn round. The wheel does all the damage. Time without beginning or end, a spoke for birth, then the grinding away, till finally the last tread and turn takes you to where you see the light or burn. There are those who never learn. The wheel does not care. It will carry a king to war or tarry, so time seems to stand still. Then all at once it rushes on, and suddenly you hear the final gong. I beat away upon the steel. The king's carriage moves apace. The flag that gloriously soared above the field now is but a cape that drapes a casket, the first step in becoming dust, as we all must. It's a job done. It must be done. If not for me, then someone else. You know the tune, and soon as bits and bites take flight and turbine still, there will still be a wheel. Your fate sealed as a life torn by dread, the threads woven about the radio, until no one can learn when one will break, another take the face of the last one's place. Fate never tells. There is no magic spell, just the hum of the wheel. Its occasional screams for oiling in anyone's blood will do. death paved so many patches, it's hard to tell who went first or who shall go last. All that matters is I do my job until the last breath. And fun.
That was absolutely an amazing read there, Rex. Thank you. And Bobby, your thoughts?
Wow, I'm still digesting this. It starts so simply. I'm only the blacksmith, and then it starts like water. It just starts cascading, and into a crescendo, and it's time without beginning or end. A spoke for birth, then the grinding away till finally the last thread in turn. I love the first part where he says, though, I'm the one who wields the hammer, greases the hub, gets life to turn round. The wheel does all the damage. And that in itself is such a telling phrase. And it proceeds to just weave the wheel in and out of life and circumstance. King's carriage moves apace. The flag that gloriously soared above the field is now but a cape that drags a casket, the first step in becoming dust, as we all must. This is a very macabre, a very, very somber a piece, but it's profound in its thoughts. Your fate sealed even as life torn by dread, by threads woven about the radial, until no one can learn when one will break and another take. It's like talking about the tapestry of life. And then the last two lines, I mean, the conclusion, all that matters is I do my job until the last breath. This is a really superb piece of writing. Such great wordplay. The internal rhyming is exquisite. I admire that because I cannot do that, nor will I even try. But this is just so well written and so cerebral. I mean, the pieces that you've netted tonight have just been outstanding.
Oh, I have to agree. Quality work tonight. An excellent comment.
Oh, my gosh.
And Rex, your thoughts?
It's a gradation from the past to the present. The wheel of life, it turns, and it starts with the blacksmith. The wheel does all the damage. A spoke for birth, then the grinding away to find the last thread and turn takes you to where you see the light. There's that notation of aging. The spokes break down, the body breaks down, and then he continues, you've got the wheel doesn't care. The thought with King's carriage moves apace, the flag gloriously soared above the field. Now is but a cape that drapes a casket. There's a thought to not just the king, but heads of state. Everyone takes that last step. And then the thought then he moves into tires. You've got the radial. Until no one can learn when one will break and it'll take the pace of last one's place. Fate never tells. There is no magic spell, just the hum of the wheel. Its occasional scream for oil and anyone's blood will do. There's a thought to accidents, and the wheel takes more lives than most people understand. Yes, the wheel is that thought of how life actually turns itself, all at its own pace, at its own time, and we all go the same way.
I like that. There is a certain kind of feel about taking us through life and how at the end, no matter, you know, how rich you are or how poor you are, we all go. And I do like how he says the wheel does not care. The wheel is the inanimate object. You know, if death happens or life happens, if sorrow or joy happens because of a wheel, it is not because of the wheel itself, but by rather because of the human hands that either built it or controlled it. And, you know, so just a powerful, thought-provoking light. And you know, it grabs your attention when it says, I am only the blacksmith. Because you just know there's got to be more to the only, because here's someone who builds things that people's life depends on. And I really like Fate Never Tells. There's no magic spell, just the hum of the wheel. It's occasional screams for oiling in anyone's blood. There's a certain bitterness to the turning of time, and you know it's just superb imagery, a wonderful dark right, and very well done. So I like that. And all right, great comment, and go ahead and get to the next right. And all right, up next is Scarlet Ida by Iona Cosma, and it goes like this. When Ida was a little girl, she wrought wreaths of thistle and ivy. She cut short the hair of her dolls and dyed their lips in black enamel. The day she died, she saw a golden wet wheat field and the rippers. Ida came to this world without hope or fear. When she was 14, she was drinking like a Russian Koska. She smoked clove cigarettes and gave her body freely to any passerby. Really, it didn't matter anyways. One day, she knew she'd had too much, so she decided to vanish like whitewash watercolor from an old canvas. The mirror where she beheld her grotesque face and garments said nothing of her troubled, frail soul. On Selenary Rock, she landed, lending her body to the lunar limelight. She was clad in clouds, for clouds are mercy. She somersaulted into galaxies and constellations that drew a map of the inverted world of slumber. The makeup was fading little by little like ancient pyrography that was no longer needed. Her cheeks recovered a rosy hue that matched the scarlet dusk, the crimson dawn, the lipstick, and the blood on her slit wrists. End poem. Oh, wow, that was just a powerful, emotive write, just beautifully written. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, that opening stanza kind of hits the painter where she's going. When Ida was a little girl, she wrought wreaths of thistles and ivy. She cut short the hair of her dolls and dyed their lips in black enamel. The day she died, she saw a golden wheat field and the rippers. So there's a kind of a painful quasi-thought to note in with the rippers. Is that why she drank like a Russian off the belt and smoked cigarettes at 14? And gave her body away freely because she'd already been ripped, so to speak. And her grotesque face and garments said nothing of her troubled frail soul. There was kind of a heavier note said with the thought of the lipstick and the blood on her slit wrist that kind of paint the thought to dawn and dusk. That was a dark note.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I like that you, wonderful comment. I especially like that you did bring up that first stanza, because I think it gives an important note to the idea that this was not somebody who started out a damaged woman. This was somebody who once was a young girl who lived near wheat fields and, you know, just, you know, so excellent comment there. And Bobby, your thoughts?
This is a really interesting, really well-written piece. It's a story, I mean, from start to finish, but it picks up momentum so quickly that you're in a headlong rush at the end, and the language in it is so well done. It's a very articulate piece. I mean, she somersaulted into galaxies and constellations that drew a map of the inverted world of slumber. Very interesting phrase. But I like the makeup was fading little by little like ancient pyrography, which is actually wood burning. And
I think
that's
something
to
do with burning.
Yeah, it's wood burning. It's an ancient art. And I like the way she likens the fading makeup to almost looking like wood burning, which it does. It gets very stark, and it just it looks warning spots that no longer needed. Cheeks recovered a rosy hue, matched the scarlet duck, the crimson dawn, the lipstick, and the blood at her slit wrists. Wow, talk about a gut punch ending. This whole thing speaks of a hard life that almost gives you no sense of any redemption, the possibility for any redemption anywhere. And then there's the last act of despair at the end. This is quite a deep and dark and visceral write.
Absolutely. I have to agree. Extremely dark and visceral, and emotionally just sad. It makes an impact. And in the fact that she brings us through this woman's life within just a few stanzas, so we see where she was that young girl, and we see where she became damaged, and where she tried to, you know, comfort herself and forget about life with the crutch of drinking and sex given to anybody who wanted it. And then the end, you know, where, you know, to me, with she somersaults in galaxies and constellations, speaks almost of like an overdose type feel to it. And then I like that she doesn't mention the slitting of the wrist until the very end, because I feel that by not making the whole entire poem about that moment,
yeah,
it becomes stronger as an ending line. So
to conjure such a detailed backstory from looking at this portrait is quite impressive.
Absolutely,
I agree.
Really,
good storytelling.
Yeah. One of my favorite things is when people write to a painting or a piece of artwork and do more than just describe it, like backstories,
yeah,
or metaphors that are layered within. All right. And up next, we have The Portrait of Mary Block by Nan529. And Bobby, would you give that a read for us, please?
Yes, ma'am. In fact, I was admiring this. I wrote to her because I really admired this piece. I'd already commented on it. The Portrait of Mary Block. Fear me you should, my dear. Come closer. Let me smell your blood. Pretty little thing carrying inside you my elixir to make me young. Before you, an old woman, gems sparkling around my neck. I saw you looking at my pearl earring. Aren't they precious, my dear? I smile as now you are in my power. I was once young, too. Long, long time ago, I was a countess. Elizabeth, not Mary, my alias. I found the secret of eternal life. Pity you must die. What care I for mortals? You are just food to me. Carefully, I dress in red. It doesn't show the odd drops of blood. Sinking my fangs into your alabaster neck, sweet, sweet warm blood. I feel my body changing, my sagging skin. Now tightening once more, I am young again. Shame I can't see my own reflection in the mirror. I shall wander into the garden and look in the water. Stand up straight, no more old bones. She picks up her silk gown as she walks to the lake before her reflection of a beautiful woman. She laughs to herself that it was so worth it. She orders her faithful servants to throw the girl's body down the well. She congratulates herself, turning this way and that as the servant picks up the lifeless body, he hauls it to the well. Head first, her body falls down into the deep black well. He waits in silence to hear the splash. It came quicker than he expected. Rushing back, he bowed to the countess. Mistress, the well is full. She looks at him coldly. Then we must move house again and make sure you seal up the well. End poem.
Wonderful read there, Bobby, and thank you for that writing it. I have to say, I really like the direction she took this, especially because within that artwork, it's, and I'm very curious at who Mary Block is. I'll have to admit I did not get a chance to look that up. I'm curious about that. Also, this is another piece of his artwork that's in at the Chicago Art Institution. But with this piece of art, what I found fascinating was the fact that there didn't seem to be as much misery with this character. This seemed to be a very well-off, very controlled in her emotions, and almost like a look of smug confidence. And I think going through the Elizabeth Bathory approach was just absolutely brilliant. And Rex, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I like the draw to the Blood Countess Elizabeth Bathory. That's what she hits on in that second stanza. I smile as now you are in my power. I was once young too. Long, long time ago, I was a Countess Elizabeth, not Mary, my alias. And the draw to the blood, but she's taken it to a deeper angle. Rather than bathe in it, she's walked the thought of Dracula with the actual drinking the blood to keep her beauty visual. And I like the thought in the last stanza too, dropping the bodies down the well. But she did. She had her servants haul the bodies off to all manner of places where they kind of left them out in the open, because she was the ruling party in her part of Transylvania back in the day. So until it got out of hand. But this Mistress the Well is full. She looks at him coldly. Then we must move house again. Make sure you seal up the well. That's kind of there's a thought there to what's her name, Anne Rice, the way she offers up a thought.
Oh, I like that. I like that. And you're right. And then plus it has a very calculated feel to it. And excellent comment. And Bobby, you read that beautifully. Your thoughts?
I'm going to read my comment. It was a very imaginative retelling of the history of Countess Elizabeth Bathory de Esczed, a Hungarian noblewoman from the family of Bathory who owned land in the Kingdom of Hungary. Bathory has been labeled by Guinness World Records as the most prolific female murderer, although the number of her victims is debated. And she saw Bathory's story in the Ivan Olbright painting, and that she conjures it. I smile as now you're in my power. Long ago I was a Countess Elizabeth, not Mary. And this is based on a true story, all the more terrible and terrifying because it actually happened. She a blood splashed on her, and she felt that it was like a youth elixir, and so she started gathering young women, virgins from the neighboring towns and villages, and murdering them wholesale, and bathing and wearing their blood, and like Rex said, and she would just the servants would drag them into the woods. There were bodies all over the place, but she was convinced that this was giving her eternal youth, and the fact
absolutely,
that she saw that in the painting is just remarkable.
Oh, I have to agree. And I like that she based it on a true story, and yet there's that kind of sense of mythology too, because as it was mentioned, it's a vampire type story, like the Countess didn't die. She lived on. She found new forms. and yet the desire for blood still lives within that new form. So definitely a creative dark take on the prompt, and
yeah,
and very well done.
Wonderfully, wonderfully imagined too.
Yep, I have to agree. And all right, next we have I Run From His Harp Screaming, yep, by Pink Fairy 5. And it goes like this. Art of Ivan Albright, I hear a death rattle, feel gloom, despise grayscaleness, flat black paint kind of background, lecherous sky, creepy skeletal hands, craggy face. Shirt looks dingy, dirty, smudged, tablecloth and dank, dour, dusty grays and blacks, morose, macabre, teeniest pops of color. I run from his art screaming pink and orange and gold. All right, well, gee there, Pink Fairy. Why don't you tell us how you really feel about the artwork? Please, don't hold back.
That.
Right? And that was a great, fun ending. Bobby, your thoughts?
Interestingly enough, I've been trading texts with Pink Fairy recently, and I found out she is, in fact, herself an artist. And she does like 10 or 15 canvases a week. She's mostly cartooning, but she does paint, and she's a very prolific artist. So when I read this, this wasn't on Ivan Albright, and actually I also find his art very grotesque and macabre, but I love her appraisal of the picture and then her end reaction. I was screaming from his heart. I just that little flip there is just wonderfully tongue in cheek, wry humor. But being that she's an artist, I understand it now.
Absolutely, absolutely. I did like you said, the wry tongue in cheek humor. I also like how it's a nice little reminder that we can appreciate an artwork and an artist and not have it be personally our taste. So because
right,
we are
exactly,
such a variety
yeah.
of people. Yeah. And
yes.
And Rex, your thoughts.
It's a bite at the vividity of the painting in shallow colors minus the blood red rose, which does punctuate the darkness that sits within. And there's the background as that something you should be afraid of, kind of hints at that note of, I've seen this movie before, and the screen pink and orange has that flavor of the color being puked out of one's mouth in the moment.
I like that. I like that. It does. I like how you said, I've seen this movie before, and I don't like the way it ends. Very cool observation. And all right, up next we have Makers of a Dream by Thomas Black. And then Rex, will you give that a read for us, please?
Makers of a Dream by Thomas Black. In my darkness, I lay on my side, discarded in the alloy and palladium, the silk napkin fold between my knees. A mill wheel turn in Holland, the grind unceasing. I'm lying the floor between tulips. Now I roll over to look at the new sky falling away from me in an ever-receding ceiling, falling away. I wink knowingly at the new moon, open-handed. A satellite is forever happy in that eternal orbit. I feel squeezed through a tube of time tonight on the kitchen floor, your eye languishing voice. Liquefy it and turn my knee to gelatin. A dog bark catches, unrelentless eyes stalk me constantly, in the plantation of tower and sugarcane. I continue to have the dream of copal smoke rising up to heaven, silently out the middle of the foliage. Down the hall, something resembling the future come knocking its smile. I wear the stoic frown of a man in the mimicking mockery of a dying silver mackerel. Finally, towards the end of the fourth watch, off the Mosquito Coast, a wet tiger waits in the rain for a cobalt sky to melt and become emerald, to throw a wet blanket over a bed of burning tires. And poem.
Wonderful read there, Rex, and thank you for sharing this right with us, Thomas. Really enjoyed this one. Excellent dark right. And Bobby, your thoughts?
This is an intriguing right. The visual imagery is there, but it's somewhat disjointed, and I like the way he is used, or I should say misused, language, verb tenses, in that it gives it a disjointed feel, along with the storytelling. It's like you glance at something and you don't believe what you're seeing, so you have to look at it again and you still don't believe it. It's an interesting, it's one of those pieces that you have to read it over again to really appreciate it. But I like the last stanza, especially down the hall, something resembling the future come knocking. What a great line. It smiled. I wear the stoic frown of a man in the mimicking mockery of a dying silver mackerel. I really like the metaphors and the way that they're constructed. It's a very interesting piece. Like I said, it's complex, very layered.
Absolutely. And I like the way you said disjointed, because I think that a perfect word to describe how this is like going through different dreams, different alternate realities almost of the mind. An excellent observation. And Rex, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
Well, it hits on the title, Makers of a Dream. And he throws up the thought, REM 1, REM 2, REM 3. So I'm hitting on the angle of dreaming, rapid eye movement, of the dream. And he's walking from one to the next. The first is that thought of alloy and palladium. So you're offering up that silver fold of evening. Mill will turn in Holland to grind unceasing. The line on the floor between two lips is kind of a note to death, almost. The nude sky falling away, the receding ceiling, there's that opening up of everything. And I wink knowingly at the moon, open-handed. A satellite is forever happy in that eternal orbit. There's that knowing thought of looking at the moon, and it's there every night. And the next one, squeeze through the tube of time. On the floor, your languishing voice, liquefied termite needed gelatin. Okay, a melting of the knees in the moment. You can't hold oneself up. The dog barking, plantation of power, sugar cane. And then again, you've got the thought of something rising, this time copal smoke, which rises heavenward out of the middle of the foliage. And then you've got on the last line, you've got a bed of burning tires. Again, the smoke that rises heavenward, a dying silver mackerel. There's that sort of flopping about on the shore, taking your last breath, so to speak.
I like that. I have to say, Rex, it is always a delight to listen to you dig into a poem.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Agreed.
Absolutely. Wonderful comments, and I have to say, I like how this seems to be about a person who goes into that rapid eye movement, that dreaming part of sleep, three different times, and it's almost like a bombardment of imagery, and yet it works so well. I really did like the mimic and mockery of a dying silver mackerel, and the where does it liquefy it and turn my knee to gelatin. There's it's very eerie lines there. You just that sense of having a nightmare, and I really like how a lot of this imagery, you could almost picture it being in a surrealism type painting, like a Salvador Dali.
Well, that's how
I like dreams really happen.
You don't get a vetted thought within a dream unless you go to bed thinking on something. Then the dream works that way. But this is cohesive in the thought that everything is kind of looped in a little strange mannerisms in moments, like the dog bark, eye crawling on the ground, so to speak. That type of thing is all surreal.
And I continue to have the dream of copal smoke rising. And copal smoke is a pre-Columbian Mesoamerican incense used in ceremonies. But he's got it up to the heaven, out of the middle of the foliage. So you've got this incense rising out of the jungle. That's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. We're going to try to get one or two more done. Let's see how things go. And we will have a few carryovers for the next dark show. So just to let people know. And up next is Morbid Midnight by Nose Ring Poems. And it goes like this. Calling from the earthly lumen, drenched in elusive obsessus, hours churning towards Scrobus, chill, scarves, taper, burning all realms, decaying wrinkles, outwardly steers, flashing crippled skin, seasons drifted, drugging artsy bloom, poisoning nerves, twisting, magicka, bouncing into gray barren, ruining own casual, neath bristles of hysteric wrath, skeletal unfurls, painstaking, appetizer's grievance, daemon of glamour, satiating ravenous hunger, driving haze of ornamental decor, gulping down to last droplet of blood. Those melancholic roars, elegantly wrapped, fallen leaf, feeding fabricated bones within deserted bowl, wicked jest, savoring own sketched, catastrophe, hallucinatio, kingdom, springs, arrows, fermentages, erring mark of enchanting bell, cupping leftover dangling trinkets of stardust, coughing, darkling thrush at rustic gate of broken plume, nubium canopy, weathered orbs, drunken, unshrunken, vile, lamented, mold, high stake, viaculum, library, everyone's verbal gaze, mockery, dabbing contour with powdered blusher, composite grease paint, strokes, grasp, drowning frame, masterpiece lost in oblivion, mimicked whispers, eyesore, hellkite beast, body mutilated, flesh ruptured, black thorn splintered, receding film dragged, screen, weld, shadow leaped, festering through pile of plague, impulse, hung in deep, floss of seeds, puffils, scattered on floor, withers, presenteth its glittery trance, swallowing supercilious priggishness. We're crawling in dawn, seems darker, reflexio, real, forbidden, in own dimensio, reeks, spoiler, bait, weeks, temptress howling, hubris lens, consuming oxidized colors of morbid midnight. And poem. Oh my goodness, that one has just a lot of beautiful, dark imagery and very emotive. I like that.
You read that
and
well.
Rex, absolutely. Oh, thank you. Thank you. and Rex, your thoughts?
Well, it bites on obsession. Daemon of glamour, satiating ravenous hunger, stabbing haze of ornamental decor gulping down to the last droplet of blood. It's kind of a 17th century feel because she hits on that second stamp. It hits the sconces paper, burning all realms, decaying wrinkles out with fists, flashing crippled skin. Sconces, I say wall sconces, but I'm thinking the sconces because you mentioned the taper. She's talking candlestick sconces, which adds a little depth to the 17th century feel, or maybe even early 18th century. Darkness and the thickness, the cloying atmosphere that runs within this artsy bloom. Let's see what else we got here. Hysteric wrath. And then there's feeding fabricated bones within deserted bough. I know she's sitting on that note of the ballerina, but it kind of walks a thought of a little bit of almost vampirish feel with the last drop of blood gulping down to the last droplet of blood, or offering up that last droplet of blood. And let's see what else we have. Nubilum canopy. I like that thought, Nubilum. And Ridiculum library. Ridiculum. It kind of has me thinking of Harry Potter in the moment for some reason. But yeah, that's
it. It does kind of have that feel console, like a spell.
Powered blusher, composite grease paint, strokes, grass, browning frame, masterpiece, lost in oblivion, mimic whispers, I saw hellkite beast. They're kind of painting the ugliness in the picture, but there is no real ugliness with that picture itself. So this kind of portrait on the inside almost kind of walks that thought of Damien.
Wow.
Dorian Gray.
I have to agree, and there's a real sense that you mentioned the ugliness on the inside. There's a real sense to me of somebody whose vanity has taken over their life and will do anything to get back the beauty that they once had. I think that was some wonderful observations there, Rex. And Bobby, your thoughts?
Another exquisitely dark, complex rite. As you were reading it, though, I was called to mind Dante's Inferno and the Nine Circles of Hell. Because as it's like she's describing this descent into hell. With each stanza, you're getting deeper and deeper until finally, you know, you weeps, temptress, howling, hubris lens, consuming oxidized colors of morbid midnight, and you've arrived at hell. And that's what it reminded me of, is the nine circles of hell and the descent into hell for each circle. And that's...
Crippling.
It's just because if you look at it, the circles are, I think, if I remember correctly, limbo, lust, gluttony, greed, anger, heresy, violence, fraud, and if you read them that way, you read a little bit of that into each one of those, because you're talking about we talk about lust and gluttony, fabricated bones with a deserted bow. That's what it feels like to me. And that is so complex and so layered, and this was an impressive, almost a mirroring of that style.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. It was a beautiful, dark, and complex rite with layered metaphors, and I appreciate that. And I would, of course, like to say thank you to Rex, as always, for being a wonderful co-host to fill my eyes for all she does. Thank you to Lawrence Babbler and, of course, you, Bobby, for calling in.
Thank you.
And thank you to those who wrote for the show, who are listening now or will be listening
Great
later.
Great contest.
We appreciate you all. Thank you so much. And join us 10 p.m. tonight, Eastern U.S. time, for Fill My Eyes and company with poetry. And at Saturday, 12:30 a.m., Aphasiana, part sinner, part saint. And Rex, what do you got going on for Sunday?
What is Sunday?
Music that lights your muse or lights your fire or something.
Yeah, an invite to offer up that which tickles your mind and soul. It could be anything from a range of genres and musicality.
Wonderful. I'm looking forward to that show because there's going to be such a diversity of rights. So, very cool idea. All right. Have a good night, everyone. Love you all.
Ciao.
Good night, gang.